from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Lois Reitzes, and this is City Lights. Thanks for listening. This is our daily look at the arts and culture of our city and the creative minds that make it work. Today, we're talking with some heavyweights of our city's literary and theatrical scenes. Darren Wong tells us about his role as up-and-coming novelist, as well as champion of the written word in the South. And first, Richard Garner is here to talk about the Alliance Theatre's production of Shakespeare in Love. The Bard himself must be very pleased that Richard Garner is directing the Alliance Theatre's production of Shakespeare in Love. The acclaimed actor and director joins us in studio now. Richard, welcome back to City Lights.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here again with you, Lois.
Lovely to have you. And I know that the Alliance Theatre's artistic director, Susan Booth, has held you in the highest regard since her arrival here earlier in the century. I love saying that. You've worked together before, and I'm curious about how this collaboration unfolded. Whose idea was it to present Shakespeare in Love?
Well, Susan, In the best way of bless her heart.
Yes.
Before, when the Alliance knew they were going to do this exciting offsite season because of the renovations, she said to me, gosh, a year and a half ago, she said, Richard, I want you to be a part of it. I don't know what it will be yet. I don't know where it will be, but let's just keep talking. And so we talked through a couple of different ideas, and the rights for Shakespeare in Love had not been released at that time when we were talking, so it wasn't really on the radar then. And we went around, you know, we were trying to find maybe non-traditional theater spaces and maybe do, you know, this show or that show. And then she said, Richard, I just found out we've got the rights for Shakespeare in Love, and the Conant Theater is available. Are you in? And I said, are you kidding me? Yes. So it's an artistic homecoming in many ways. Yeah.
Yes. The movie was a huge success. Yeah. I think it won 7 Academy Awards in 1998. 16 years later, it was adapted for the theater. How do you think Shakespeare in Love translates for the stage?
You know, I think it actually is made for the live theater. I'm sort of surprised this isn't one of those cases where it was a play first and then made into a film.
Really?
Because it's such a celebration of the act of live theater. You get to go backstage. You get to see a playwright struggling, you know, to break through writer's block to come up with the right words. Then you get to see a company of actors rehearsing those words and then putting on the performance. And it's just a celebration of what we in live theater do. So I think its perfect home is in the theater. In the live theater, yeah.
That's very refreshing to hear you say, because in preparation for this, I went back and looked at some reviews of the London production, the original production, which were mixed.
They were mixed. Some said, "Oh, just a really delightful day in the theater," and others. And I saw that too when I was when I first found out about the script. I checked those reviews, and also at Stratford Festival in Ontario, where the same director then came and continued to work. And I tried to figure out what was it about those? Because when I read the script, it's a great piece of theater. It should really work well. And I talked to a guy, a fellow who runs the Vancouver Shakespeare Company, and I said, did you see that production in Stratford? And do you know why it would have gotten those mixed reviews? He says, yeah, you know, it was a lively, real fun production. But the Romeo and Juliet scenes within the play, they sort of camped up a bit.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, well, that's in. I mean, that's a choice. I see how, you know, there's a lot of comedy in the piece. I see why you might go that way. But it's also kind of the emotional center of the piece, because that's not just Romeo and Juliet. It is Will Shakespeare and his muse Viola falling in love. And that's what, you know, it's his love for her. Of course, it's all fictional, that makes him write Juliet. And so I think you need to treat that with, you know, with full sincerity. And so I don't know if that's it. But when I look at it as a piece of theater, it should work. Here's fingers crossed.
Well, I know in subsequent stage productions, it was very well received in Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago, Oregon, sure. Shakespeare, Utah this summer. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's, reviews can be snarky.
Yeah.
And those two in particular, I thought, were.
Right.
Your trademark as artistic director of Georgia Shakespeare was a contemporary approach. Mm-hmm. I think you once described it as bringing the stories to the audience today rather than bringing the audience back to the story. How does Shakespeare in Love fit with that mission?
Well, you know, it's sort of perfect. It's a contemporary play. And it's about essentially a man that, you know, I spent a career doing this man's works, but we never really looked at the man on stage. And so this is a contemporary fictional account of who Shakespeare the man was. And so to me, when we were looking at this, you know, you could set it in a picture-perfect sort of, you know, Elizabethan playhouse, which serves some scenes well, not others so well. Or you can take a little, you know, more open approach. So what we've done is you'll see in our scenery even, Angela Callan, a really brilliant designer I'm working with, I said, you know, I want the feel of those timbers of an Elizabethan playhouse, but also I want lightning quick speed to be able to change scenery and location and things. And so we have wheels out there, which wouldn't have been in Elizabethan productions. And so things spin and turn on a dime, and you're seeing these structures that remind you of, you know, the architecture of the period, but also there's sort of an interesting, not intentionally contemporary nature about it, but just to feel that, you know, this play that's a modern play about a period, that it sort of blends scenically with what the play itself does on the page. So that's kind of our approach. And so far, it's working.
Well, we have a clip from one of your rehearsals that illustrates how this play portrays Shakespeare as a real human being, a working artist. Let's hear Will Shakespeare with the playwright Christopher Marlowe.
Shall I compare thee to an autumn morning? Mm. An afternoon in springtime?
A sonnet! I thought you were writing a play.
A month overdue to Henslowe and nothing comes. I've lost my gift, kid. I don't know what it is. My quill is broken. My well is dry. The proud tower of the imagination has collapsed completely.
Interesting. And how are your marital relations, Will?
The Hathaways?
The bedroom.
As cold as her heart.
Then you are free to love.
Yet not to write, so it seems. Leave me, kid.
I've almost finished my new play for Burton. More blood and thunder, but he pays well for it. I hear he plays your two gentlemen of Verona for Her Majesty this very afternoon.
My play for the Queen?
A summer's day.
What?
A summer's day. Start with something lovely, temperate, and thoroughly trite. Give you somewhere to go.
So Shakespeare could have had writer's block at times,
and <he did.
laughs> maybe wasn't above running with another playwright's idea.
Yeah.
The human side.
Yeah. This is great. This is just one example. Later on, Marlowe basically gives Will the outline to Romeo and Juliet, and even plants a seed for Othello for later. So, you know, it's sort of inside jokes about how writers can work together. But yeah, this is a great scene. Marlowe asked him. He said, "So, how are your marital relations?" And as a fellow writer, he knows that the muse must be there, and that love is a fantastic muse for a writer. He sort of senses that his both rival and buddy is having trouble writing. So, you know, he checks on his heart. How's that going? Not so well. And so Shakespeare in Love becomes a story about how Shakespeare finds love and then refines his gift of writing together.
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes here with Richard Garner. He's directing the Alliance Theatre's production of Shakespeare in Love. We'll hear more from Richard Garner after a short break.
Support for WABE comes from Jewish Kids Groups, a new kind of Hebrew school designed for Jewish families of all backgrounds, including interfaith, featuring experiential learning in a welcoming environment. More about Sunday and after-school programs at jewishkidsgroups.com. And from Innovation Arts and Entertainment, an evening with David Sedaris at the Fox Theater, author, humorist, and contributor to This American Life, an evening of readings, book signing, and Q&A, Sunday, October 22nd, tickets at foxtheater.org.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Our guest today is Shakespeare maven Richard Garner. He was the artistic director of George's Shakespeare from 1985 to 2014. He's directing the new production of Shakespeare in Love for the Alliance Theatre at Oglethorpe University. As the plot of Shakespeare in Love unfolds, the bard is cured of writer's block when he meets Viola. Let's listen to her audition as Thomas Kent.
May I begin, sir?
Your name?
Thomas Kent. I would like to do a speech by a writer who commands the heart of every player, sir.
Yes, I'm sure.
What light is light if Sylvia be not seen? What joy is joy if Sylvia be not by, unless it be to think that she is by and feed upon the shadow of perfection. Except I be by Sylvia in the night, there is no music in the nightingale. Unless I look on Sylvia in the day, there is no day for me to look upon.
Where did you learn to do that?
At the playhouse, sir.
There is no playhouse in London where my verse is spoke, truly.
Are you Master Shakespeare?
I have not seen you audition before, Master Kent.
I am new to London, sir. I am staying at the country, at the De Lesseps in Sheen.
Oh, please, sir, speak some more. Without your hat.
My hat?
Yeah, let me see your face.
Oh, no.
Please, sir, speak it again. Let it trip off the tongue.
Sir.
Please, it's a love scene. Please take off your hat!
Just leave my hat alone!
Give me love!
Hello, young man. Who was he?
I'm Romeo! Hands off!
So, Viola becomes his muse. What's the message about feminism here, Richard?
Well, it's Viola, you know, she goes in disguise to go audition for the theater, which is absolutely forbidden by all societal norms. But she goes to the theater. She sees the theater. She attends the theater. There's a scene earlier where the play manager says, "Will, look, there's this lady who knows your plays by heart. Looks how she mouths every word." And the next scene, we see Viola with her nurse, and she's going back home. She says, there will never be true love on stage unless women can be acted by women instead of pipsqueak boys. You know? Because in Shakespeare's company's days, women's roles were played by, you know, young adolescent boys in the company. And so she says, I call it her anthem. I said, Bethany Ann Lind, who plays Viola, just, you know, radiant actress in anything she does. And just phenomenal in this. I said, "This is your anthem." And she says, "There will be true love on stage. I will have love in my life and not just, you know, ordinary. I will have unbiddable, ungovernable, a riot of the heart. And so she says, you know, if I'm going to live life, I'm going to live it on the terms that mean I'll live a full life and I won't sit down, I won't be repressed. And so she comes up with this plan. She says to the nurse, get me a boy wig and we'll bind my breast and I'm going to go and be an actor. And of course, the nurse almost faints, Tess Malice, doing a fantastic job with that. And so then Viola sets out on this journey and it's dangerous. It's dangerous for her to be there in the room that way if she's caught. In fact, the company's closed down because it comes out. So in two ways, she becomes Shakespeare's muse. She's the actor who can finally speak his verse the way he meant for it to be spoken. And then in the form of Viola, when he sees Viola later, when he goes to actually, she says, I'm the cousin of Viola de Lesseps staying at the house. So he goes to give a message saying, Thomas Kent, I've cast you as Romeo, and doesn't see Thomas Kent, but sees Viola de Lesseps in this beautiful gown at this sort of ball that's going on. He says, who is that? And then he starts quoting lines from Romeo, you know, she doth teach the torches to burn bright, and you know. And so he's smitten by her. So there's his romantic muse. And then in the other side of the same character, Thomas Kent, there's his artistic muse. So it's just, you know, it's a great story.
It is a wonderful story. It's not only an affectionate portrayal of Shakespeare as a real human being, but the play is also a love letter to the theater itself. Would you explain how that's revealed?
You know, it's even more than just the theater. I think it's a love letter to the creative spirit in people, and that. You know, it's not just love and the muse that comes from, you know, that being a muse that lets a writer write. It's people, Viola, Will, others in the play, saying that, you know, what we do matters. This is so important. We are a part of what it's like to be alive. The reason these people come to this, you know, there's a saying, hey, Will, cheer up. It's a full house. 2,000 people out there. 2,000 people in a time when London had about 100,000 people in it, in one theater space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is something that our society needs. And, of course, there are a few, you know, of those like the Lord Chamberlain who comes and calls it, you know, a sedition, a pit of filth, and all this other stuff, and wants to close it down. But the characters in the play all speak to the power of art to sort of define a well-lived life. One of the most touching moments in the play is when Will, through the course of events of the play, becomes Romeo because Thomas Kent is discovered and can't play Romeo anymore. And then, but she comes to the theater to see this performance, and their Juliet has their young boy playing Juliet, his voice breaks. And so she says, well, I know every word. And so they go, oh, well, we'll be hanged for this, but let's put her on. So they put her on. So it's Will and Viola as Romeo and Juliet. And this touching thing is the tomb scene when, you know, they discover each other, then die together. All of the other actors on the side are just leaning in almost. They're dumbfounded and almost in tears at the beauty of the art going on right there on stage, which is a reflection of the art that they provide for the rest of the world. So in that way, I think it's, you know, it's a love letter to the power of the art to actually affect hearts. And that's a great thing.
We just have a couple minutes left. I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about your cast.
Oh, my gosh. One of the things Susan Booth said when she said, let's do Shakespeare in Love and let's do it at your former home at the Conant, she said, and you know, why don't you start with a handful of your favorite actors from Georgia Shakespeare and we'll build the company around that. And this is another one of those productions where Susan said, I want this to be all Atlanta talent. It's a big production, 23 actors, and I want to showcase what we have here. So people like Joe Knezovich, Tess Malice, Chris Kaser, Neil Gant, Travis Smith, of course, Bethany, are all folks, and even a few others I've worked some other times with. You know, we've been together before. And
you're peeps.
Yeah, and we're back together on the same stage, and it's just a remarkable feeling. And then the other folks we brought into the cast we've just melded into a really wonderful ensemble together. It's a fantastic feeling.
Richard Garner is directing the Alliance Theatre's production of Shakespeare in Love at the Conant Performing Arts Center of Oglethorpe University. The play opens Wednesday, August 30th. It will be performed through September 4th at Oglethorpe.
With 24th. Through the 24th.
The 24th. Yeah. Much better.
Yeah.
I thought, well, that's an awfully limited run. Good. Deservedly so. Through September 24th. Better yet, at Oglethorpe. Richard, with a nod to the lyrics from Hello, Dolly. It's so nice to see you back where you belong.
Thank you so much, Lois.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from SunTrust Private Wealth Management, whose teams of local financial advisors can help you look beyond the portfolio so you are prepared for whatever life brings. Confidence starts here. More information at suntrust.com/reserve.
From atlantaplanet.org, here's a look at some upcoming events. Marietta's new Theater in the Square opens their version of The Glass Menagerie this Thursday, and it's the final week to see the Andy Warhol exhibit at the High Museum. It's the only place on the East Coast to see it, and Sunday's your last day. If you're looking for something to do in Atlanta, visit us at atlantaplanit.org or download the app on iTunes.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. Earlier this month, Darren Wong announced that he was resigning as executive director of the AJC Decatur Book Festival. Wong co-founded the annual event, which is heading into its 12th year this Labor Day weekend. As he leaves, he will also be launching a book at the festival, his debut novel. He joined us in our studios to talk about this change in direction. Darren Wong, I remember about, 13 years ago, you told me Decatur is the new Brooklyn. And I laughed. And now I think, wow, you really should have taken out a copyright on that, because
now Brooklyn is the old Decatur.
There you go. Brooklyn, the literary epicenter of the United States, and the comparison to Decatur, you founded the AJC Decatur Book Festival.
With help.
And now you have come to the decision to move on. What made you decide to resign as executive director?
It feels like a good break in my life. I've got a novel coming out, and there's just a shift in mindset. And the difference between founding a festival and running a festival is considerable, I think it's time for, I really do feel like it's time for new leadership at the festival. There's great people in place. There's great people working on the festival every day.
What do you think that leadership will look like going forward?
Here's what I hope it will include, and I've got a great board, and I'm sure that they understand this as much as anybody, that what needs to happen with the festival is kind of a continued emphasis on kind of collaboration and an overused term, but community as well. The reason the festival works as well as it does is because there is so much buy-in, I think, all around Decatur and in the writing community. And Julie Wilson, who is the program director for the festival, she doesn't have a long background in books or anything. She has a passion for it, but she has this a really intelligent mind and a great curiosity, and she's smart enough to listen to all the expertise she has in, at her at hand, and she has no problem calling up people and saying, "What about this author? What about that author? Who would round this out?" That kind of, you know, there's so many smart people in Atlanta, and the way the festival should run is to tap into that to empower what we have here.
It's undeniable that the festival has had an impact on the culture and commerce of the city of Decatur. How has that impacted you?
Well, I've had a gig for 12 years, which is nice. But, you know, it is hard to, it's really hard to kind of quantify what, you know, what it means to, you know, to run the Decatur Book Festival for 12 years, to have been kind of welcomed into the city of Decatur in that way, you know. You know, there's the sense of belonging that comes from it. And you know, being part of what is a really special place, more than anything, that's what it means to me, I think.
What are you looking forward to doing next Labor Day, Darren?
Are you kidding? Look, I get to go to all the sessions. I get to go to the parties. Somebody says something's going wrong, I go get another drink. I don't care. What could be better?
Well, here is wishing you congratulations on launching this very exciting event.
Well,
that's
you.
Now a part of, you know, the creative community's DNA here.
Well, thank you. It's been a great trip. It's been a lot of fun.
After a break, Darren Wong will talk about his debut novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. You're listening to City Lights on WABE.
Support for WABE comes from Live Nation, welcoming El Devo to Chastain Park Amphitheater this Saturday night. Tickets are on sale now at livenation.com. That's international vocal group El Devo live in concert for one night only. The Atlanta Board of Education welcomes input from students, parents, staff, and the community. The next community meeting is Tuesday, September 5th at 6 p.m. in the Atlanta Public School Center for Learning and Leadership Auditorium, 130 Trinity Avenue, Southwest Atlanta. Sign-in is from 5 to 5:50 p.m. Atlanta Public Schools, with a caring culture of trust and collaboration, every student will graduate ready for college and career.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. After running the largest independent literary festival in the South for over a decade, one would think writing a book would be a natural step. Yet, Darren Wong spent years trying to give his story away. Luckily for us, no one took him up on it. And his story of the Civil War, the Underground Railroad, and a small town in upstate New York is being launched this weekend. Wong joined us in our studios to talk about The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. This is your debut novel. Tell us how you decided on the story.
The story kind of wouldn't leave me alone. I grew up in this place. It's upstate New York, 15 miles from the Canadian border, outside of Buffalo, and Town Line, New York. Even as a little boy, I'd hear these stories that it seceded from the Union.
Was it the only northern city to secede?
The only place north of the Mason-Dixon, So I heard those stories, and I also heard the story that the house that my parents owned, that we rented out, that was in front of the barn that I grew up in, and that does explain my manners. I grew up in a barn. The front house that we owned, you'd go into the cellar, and there was a hidey hole dug into the wall of the cellar, and there's a huge brass bell hanging in a belfry over the roof, and none of this makes sense, you know. But this is, if you know, your six-year-old boy, this is where you live. This is just the way things are. And you know, as I grew older and came south and started to understand the history of place, did I really start diving into this story, and it just got stranger and stranger.
Well, certainly it must have felt like a certain vindication that the house you were living in was formerly a stop on the Underground Railroad, when in fact the town you were living in was the only northern city to secede.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you say city, you have to think. I mean, the vote was 80-23 to secede. This is not a
little town,
but it's. The contradiction of those two things. This old house in the middle of the town, the hamlet, running an underground railroad station, and the town seceding, you know, that was always conflated in my memory, but only, you know, once I started researching it, and what happened was I found an oral history of the Willis family that had built this house and built the farm, and I'd never heard the name Willis growing up in this place. There's plenty of other names memorialized on streets and stuff in Townline, New York, but the Willis family that founded the town is not mentioned anywhere.
Strange.
Yeah. So it leads to this idea of the alienation between the founder and the place. And that was really, that was interesting to me. And it also, you know, I grew up, I'm half Chinese, and you know, growing up in this place that, if you pull up the demographics of Alden, New York, or Townline, New York right now, which is it is still 99% white. You know, it's a small rural farming town. There's not, you know, there's not a lot of moving back and forth. And so I understood that alienation, you know, that kind of separation from place.
You had the oral history then, and you did some research on your own. I read that you tried pitching the story to other authors.
Well, yeah, you have. So the story focuses on Mary Willis, right? This woman who graduates from Alfred University, 1858, and it was only the second school in the country to accept women. Oberlin was the first, Alfred was the second, right? And so she's radical. This is a radical choice to go to college in 1856, 1857. She graduates 1858, and she comes home to start running an underground railroad station. And it's wild. I mean, she's an abolitionist. She's a radical feminist, and I'm thinking, you know, in the middle of this very odd town in the other direction. But and then I start researching the greater area, and Western New York. There's an argument to be made that Western New York was the most radical place in the world in the first half of the 19th century. So Frederick Douglass is operating in Rochester, the root of abolitionism, essentially, right? The meeting for where feminism starts with Elizabeth Cady Stanton is over in Seneca Falls. There's a large collection of literature around radical religions that start in Western New York. Of course, Mormonism starts in Western New York outside of Rochester. Spiritualism starts in it's our backyard. I found the border of our backyard was across the creek was owned by a group called the Ebenezers, the Community of True Inspiration, that was a essentially at that point was a communist cult, where the children were, a child was born, it was raised in commune, and all the men, when it came time for harvest, all the men would line up on one side of the field and beat in rhythm and harvest the field at one time. And I knew none of this. I knew none of this growing up there. And you start finding these stories, and you start pulling these threads, and you say, I mean, a woman that was living there both, you know, both would feel really isolated, but would also feel really engaged, or be yearning to be engaged.
So you couldn't get any writers to bite.
No, you can only write the book that you're called to, right? You never take the book that somebody else pitches to you.
Darren, the research must have been extensive. I mean, when did you feel like you had enough background to begin the novel?
You know, I could have just kept going. I could still keep going. I still pull, you know, every time something comes up, I'll go down another rabbit hole. You know, I think that the moment that kind of what was kind of transformative for me is I'd sat down and started writing, and I had a draft, and I had something, and it wasn't really gelling for me. And because it was the Civil War, I was focusing on the South, which was the logical thing, right? What I realized was I asked myself, what was happening at the Canadian border? What was Canada, you know, which is always, I mean, it's 15 miles away. And that just blew everything up for me, because there's this whole history of the Confederacy and Canada that is completely unexplored.
Not now. Not through your fiction. The character of Mary Willis is memorable, to say the least. Would you read a portion of the book to give us an idea of her character?
Sure, of course. I'd love to. So this is after, soon after Mary's professor at Alfred has kind of started her on the path of helping fugitives along. With each fugitive she carried downtown, Mary felt as if she were sending something of herself into the world. She understood that there were dozens of others like her in the chain of barns and chicken shacks where each fugitive had sheltered, and in that, she felt some kinship, some belonging. She wished that there were some way she could send word back to each hand that had helped and let them know that they had been delivered, that their risks had not been in vain. But she could not, of course. She could know the previous stop, and she could know the next, but nothing more. The fugitives themselves were almost too much for her. They were suspicious of everything and everyone. The fear of their master back home and the pursuing hunters ran so deep in them that she struggled to fathom where they mustered the strength to run at all. Whenever she asked them about their trip, they would say as little as they could, instinctively protecting their protectors. As the same caution worked in her favor, she knew she should be grateful, but she longed to know more. She could not deny that she enjoyed the secrecy of it all, though.
Mary Willis's belief in humanity could not be farther removed from Scarlett O'Hara's attitudes. But they share a quality of fierce independence that was very rare for that time period. I wondered if you had that in mind when I read the passage on page 160, where Mary's in despair, kneeling in the snow, and then something becomes very clear to her, and I'm quoting, "She pulled her hair into place, straightened her back, and turned back to the house, knowing her way forward for the first time in months." Darren, is that your response to Scarlett's "As God is my witness" soliloquy?
You know, it certainly reads that way. Maybe it was, but I didn't do that consciously. I'll tell you that. I had an homage to Scarlett at one point in the book, but it didn't make the cut. At one point, I had actually lifted the physical description of Scarlett O'Hara from the book and put it in there, but I ended up cutting the character's appearance out largely. She shows up at one point, but you wouldn't know her from there.
17-inch waist and all. Yeah. Smallest in three counties.
I think it was a description of her face. I think the green eyes and the eye, but I can't remember.
If you are just joining us, we're speaking with Darren Wong. His debut novel is The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. It launches at the Decatur Book Festival this weekend. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment here on 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from Kindred Healthcare. Gentiva Home Health and Hospice are now part of the Kindred family. Registered nurses are available to answer healthcare questions at 1-866-KINDRED. Caring for patients, honoring life. And from Emory Schwartz Center for Performing Arts. Presenting The Yellow Ticket, the rarely seen 1918 film, accompanied live with the original score by violinist Alicia Svigals. Thursday, September 7th at 8 p.m. arts.emory.edu.
We're back with City Lights here on WABE Atlanta. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to continue my conversation with Darren Wong, co-founder of the AJC Decatur Book Festival and author of the novel The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. All of the characters are richly drawn. Would you give us a thumbnail sketch of Nathan, Joe, and Leander, Mary's brother?
So I'll do my best. So Nathan is, Nathan's where it all starts. Nathan's Mary's father, and he came west from Vermont, 1811. He's a settler, right? He's a pioneer, and there weren't a lot of people around at that time, and kind of one of the hidden backstory is this progression from nowhere to being in the middle of somewhere throughout the book. So Nathan is the real Nathan Willis, the historical character. His father and his older brothers fought in the Revolutionary War. His uncles all did. He was born right around the time the Constitution was ratified. He feels like an essence of America to me. So he's a kind of strong, independent, stern man who's widowed fairly young, left with to raise these two kids kind of in a changing pioneer landscape. But he's a county commissioner and he's very involved in politics and he's very he loves to work and he loves to farm and he loves to make things grow.
And he had a wonderful relationship with the tribe that inhabited that area.
So, one of the things that happened in the research of this, I ended up going to this little house museum not far from this house that I'd grown up in. And I walk in and there's these two big display cases marked the Willis Collection. And they were all of these Indian artifacts that had been found on our farm in the first half of the 20th century that I didn't know about, right? So suddenly I have a sense that this place had not only, did it have the history of the Willises, but it also had this place of this history of the Indians, the Haudenosaunee, and specifically the oral history shows him hiring Haudenosaunee to work his sawmill, so it seemed important that relationship that would have been a big part of his life.
Joe is an extraordinary character. He's my favorite character, and those are some pretty likable characters you've got. He loves to read, and Henry David Thoreau's writing makes a profound impression on him. Would you talk about the significance of On Walden Pond in this book of yours?
Yeah, well, it is. We think about Walden as a place of retreat for in our lives of privilege, I guess. You think about everything that intrudes in our life. There's the idea of going and having a place by the pond of peace and contemplation. There's something idealized about that. But if you're a fleeing slave, that would mean something completely different. The idea, that would be there's another level of ideal there. There's peace, and you know, there's an idea of having something of your own, and the idea of being away from everything that is in pursuit of you. So it Joe latches onto that as, you know, as his goal, in essence. You know, this is what if you can't imagine what's next for you, and then you read that description, it becomes lodged in your mind as the thing.
How does writing, the act of writing, become Joe's salvation?
It's, you know, because Joe is injured. I mean, in the, you know, the very first pages of the book, and he ends up convalescing in one way or the other, and ends up in prison as well, for quite a while. And that's, you know, it's his way forward. It's in essence, it's his, it's how he becomes. He recreates himself, in essence, from a fleeing slave to something else, to a leader, and to really become, you know, to become a man in his own eyes, I think.
There are aspects of this story that are frighteningly familiar today, and the part that echoed the most for me was when Leander is in the barber shop. And the barber gives his answer to what this war's about.
Yeah, that's true. That moment, you know, Leander's, he's on his way back toward Buffalo from being away for a long time, and he stops to get cleaned up before he presents himself at home for the first time in years. And the barber says, "Well, I wouldn't go down." Downtown, there's a lot of storms are brewing, essentially, and it's around shipping up these folks from down south to take our jobs and to.
And I thought, oh my God, this is not only racism, but it's also anti-immigrant and too much that resonates for the present. But I loved that part for the chills it gave me. At the Decatur Book Festival event for this book, Darren, you will be in conversation with Charles Frazier, who won the National Book Award for Cold Mountain. Does that seem surreal?
How could it not? You know, and Natasha Trethewey is coming down and introducing me.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know what to say to that.
Okay.
I really don't know what to say.
I guess.
I mean, it is surreal. It's astounding. I wrote part of this book on the desk that Charles wrote Cold Mountain. I wrote just about 500 words on it. I'm not sure they all how many made it into the final draft, but there's a little bit of, you know, I mean, Cold Mountain left a big impression on me as I was writing, and I don't think, I'm not going to claim that there's much in common, but I do. There are aspects of it that I was aiming for.
So, a former poet laureate of the United States and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Natasha Trethewey, is introducing you. Charles Frazier will be in conversation with you to read the blurbs. The endorsements of this book is like a who's who in literary America, Darren. Clearly, some of the association you had with the Decatur Book Festival helped you in the recognition of this book.
Well, more than that, the book festival allowed me to, you know, because some of the relationships I have that have allowed me to have people read this book in various forms and offer me advice that would cost a lot of money to get otherwise. You know, people have been generous that way to me, and it's, you know, I've never taken a writing class, but I've had a master class of advice from a lot of great writers over the years.
History lessons, suspense, espionage, adventure, and moments of great beauty are found throughout this book, Darren.
Wow, Lois.
Congratulations on your debut novel, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lois. I've been looking forward to talking to you about this book for years.
Darren Wong's debut novel is The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. He launches the book this Saturday at the Decatur Book Festival, where he will be in conversation with the best-selling author and winner of the National Book Award, Charles Frazier. That's Saturday at 1:45 in the sanctuary of First Baptist Church of Decatur. You are listening to City Lights. You have been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. You can catch an encore broadcast of our show this evening at 8. Tomorrow morning at 11, we'll hear from the Atlanta Film Society's Chris Escobar about his purchase of Atlanta's historic Plaza Theater. I'll also speak with our contributor and New York Times best-selling author Jocelyn Jackson about her new book, The Almost Sisters. It will be featured at the Decatur Book Festival. City Lights is a production of WABE at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. I'm Lois Wrightsis. I would love it if you would follow me on Twitter, at Lois Wrightsis. That's spelled LOISREITZES. Follow this station at WABE News. That's all for today's edition of City Lights. Thanks for joining us and for listening to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.